The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Well, welcome back. I think it's safe to say that the pandemic is making a return, a surge. Actually, I was just listening to the news in the United States. They're calling it a surge on a surge. So I don't know if that qualifies as a third wave or fourth wave or what, but it's pretty serious here in Canada, in Alberta. And, you know, as I think back over the course of the last 9 months of the whole pandemic thing, when we first locked down, we were all worried about the supply chains and even getting basic food on the grocery store shelves, which got me thinking, you know, food and the oldest energy system out there, which is actually biofuels. If you think about it, you know, you feed the horse metabolizes the food, turns it into muscle energy and pulls a cart. Well, those simple systems are still with us in many parts of the world, but we've moved on just simple food for fuels. And we're now into all sorts of different realms. And in fact, we're coming back full circle as things like the Clean Fuel Standard are encouraging the resurgence of biofuels, which is fuels for made from biological materials. And actually, that's what we're going to talk about today, Jackie, because we have another special guest and we're delighted to have Doug Hooper. Doug's the Director of Policy and Regulations at Advanced Biofuels Canada, and that's an industry association just outside of Vancouver. It's a national industry association designed to promote the production and use of advanced biofuels. We're going to understand what advanced biofuels means. There's a lot of momentum behind the energy transitions. As I said, there's regulatory pushes with things like the Clean Fuel Standard. And so, well, I'm going to stop talking. Let's invite Doug. Welcome, Doug. Great to have you on our podcast.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be with both of you.
Yeah. Great, Doug. Well, thank you. And, you know, this is a complex topic. A lot of us have heard the term biofuels, but it is a broad term that encompasses a lot of different types of fuels and feedstocks. As a starting point, just tell our audience, what are biofuels at a high level and why are we thinking about increasing their use at this moment?
Yes, there's a great deal of focus on biofuels these days. And the primary driver is government regulations as countries and subnational states or provinces have introduced measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the reason is transportation represents generally a quarter to a third of total emissions in a jurisdiction, and fuel regulations have proven to be a very effective tool to tackle these. So back to biofuels. Biofuels come into the picture because they're available in large volume. They work in existing engines and fuel infrastructure, and many of them have a very low carbon intensity. I think we'll talk about that part later. Mm-hmm. But broadly, the term refers to fuels that are made from a biomass carbon source. They can be liquid, gaseous, solid. I'm going to focus today, I think, on the transport fuels that are predominantly liquid. And conventional fuels that people may recognize are ethanol, which we blend in gasoline, and typically our regular grade gasoline at the pump has 10% ethanol. And then there's two different types of biofuels that are in the diesel fuel system. One's called biodiesel, the other one's called renewable diesel. And generally, the blends in Canada are around 5% at different times during the year. And in the U.S., you see blends up to 20%. There's emerging fuels going into the aviation sector, a bio-based fuel called biojet or sustainable aviation fuel. And we're also seeing biofuels adopted in marine and rail sectors.
Let's talk a little bit about the four different categories of biofuels that that are out there. One is food. And the second one, well, I'll let you talk.
Yeah, there's been different efforts to categorize the generations, if you will, of biofuels. So generation one was conventional agricultural crops going into corn ethanol or wheat ethanol, or in the case of biodiesel, it's predominantly made from soybean oil, which is a byproduct of soybean meal, canola oil in Canada, and animal fats. And then there was definition of second generation fuels that would be closer to a drop-in, be more fungible with the fossil fuel system. And then tertiary and quaternary levels definitions for emerging fuels like synthetic fuels that can be derived from capturing carbon dioxide from the air or carbon dioxide out of flue stacks. But really, you know, the definitions don't really hold well, and the lines blur because every type of biofuel really in the system today is seeing innovation drive down carbon emissions. And so even these conventional biofuels from 10, 20 years ago are now getting emission reductions that are down as low as some of the second and third generation fuel. So it's become a sector that focuses on carbon intensity. And, you know, in terms of the carbon emissions, it gets a little complicated because we talk about them in two different ways. One is combustion emissions and the other is life cycle emissions. And combustion emissions are usually addressed by what's called renewable fuel standards, where governments set a blend requirement for a minimum blend level through the year. It doesn't have to be in every liter, but it does, by the end of the calendar year, have to represent a certain minimum content. And so renewable fuel standards are delivering combustion emission reductions because biofuels are carbon neutral. Carbon dioxide that they emit when they combust goes back up into the plant cycle, whether it's a crop or a tree, and they're recycled, whereas fossil fuels release fossil emissions.
Yeah, that's an important point that a lot of people get tripped up on because they're saying, well, wait a minute, why is this better for the environment? 80% of the emissions come at the car when we combust the hydrocarbons or the biofuels, we still get the CO2, but it's because those plants absorb the CO2. So they're not adding CO2 to the atmosphere, you know, as much as coming out of the tailpipe as they absorbed as they were growing. Is that right?
That is right. As you said, most of it does happen at the tailpipe in terms of releasing those to the atmosphere. And that's where the other form of regulation comes in. It's called a low carbon fuel standard. And there's a federal clean fuel standard now, which is built on that framework. But low carbon fuel standards focus on the full life cycle emissions of different energy products. And so in the oil industry, it's everywhere, everything from oil extraction right through to finally combusting the gasoline or the diesel in your vehicle. And the same boundaries apply to biofuels. And so it starts at the farm and the growing of the crop and the processing of that, and then the biofuel production, and then finally final use. And there we get a bit of a different measure in terms of carbon performance. The gasoline and diesel are around 90 grams per megajoule. Biofuels in Alberta, for instance, the wheat ethanol and the canola biodiesel that's made in Alberta are a score of 52 and 11 in terms of carbon intensity. So that represents a better than 50% and an almost 90% reduction in full life cycle emissions compared to the fossil fuels.
Isn't the vast majority of biofuels still coming from wheat or canola or corn?
Yes. I don't think the generation nomenclature helps us, but the vast majority in terms of what are we actually using, ethanol from corn and sugarcane and wheat is commonly used. In the biodiesel side, it's the animal fats, used cooking oil, distiller's corn oil, which comes from ethanol production, and vegetable oils like soybean oil and canola oil. And then there are now these new technologies that have been commercialized around making ethanol from municipal solid waste. And they are just commercializing, synthesizing ethanol from direct air capture and flue sack capture of CO2 gases. So there's a number of different ways.
So those ones are coming. But today, yeah, the vast majority that when we go to our gas station and we fill up our tank is coming from food. So I wanted to get to one last question around the greenhouse gas emissions. Is the controversial part is if you're using a food crop, some people have argued that, well, by growing the wheat here in Alberta that we're going to use for biofuels, there needs to be wheat grown somewhere else in order to make enough food for people. And I think the most controversial example is palm oil production. So because there's more biofuels production using palm oil, there are places in the world where they're knocking down rainforests to put up these palm oil plantations. And they're saying, well, you also have to account for the greenhouse gas emissions associated with changing the land use. And if you do that, then they're not as good for the environment as we may think.
There's two ways to go at that answer. One is around the life cycle carbon intensity and versus combustion. In the carbon intensity structure, the full life cycle is accounted. But I'll back up a bit because this really kind of breaks into two issues. One is food prices and competition for food. And your audience will recall back in 2008 or so, about mid-year, the price of oil went up over $150 US. And in the lead up to that, biofuel use and agricultural commodity prices were rising. And over that period, there was some speculation that biofuels were the cause of food price escalation. And then the recession happened and the collapse of oil prices. What happened in the markets was we saw the correlation between biofuel use and food prices to decouple. It went away, which demonstrated that biofuels were not linked to the higher fuel prices. And the UNFAO eventually looked at the data and the growth of the biofuels market and resolved that biofuels have been beneficial for global agriculture, and they've improved farm returns and built resilience and helped stabilize agricultural production communities. So there's a positive impact there. And our canola sector in Canada has one very good recent example. When China closed their market and shut off canola imports into China, caused about $1 billion to the canola sector in market loss. And fortunately, demand in Europe for biofuels helped support some of that canola demand, and they were able to shift their exports over to the European biofuel market.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to come back to the notion of the pull on food-based biofuels and the future based on increased policy and regulation. I'm going to put that aside for a minute because I think it's important to talk about that. But let's get a sense of what's going on in Canada, if we can. Can you talk about the different biofuels we're using domestically? You know, people drive up to the pump and they see the E85 or other branding of this sort of thing. Where are we at? And, you know, how much is being blended? What's the size of this business in Canada?
I'll point to research that Navius Research puts out annually. It's a Biofuels in Canada report, and you can find the report and the data set for it on their website. The 2020 report was recently released in October, I believe, and it only has data to 2018. Our data lags a bit. But what we did do in 2018 was blended just over 3 billion liters of ethanol, which was about 6.5% of the gasoline pool. And we used 350 million liters approximately of both biodiesel and renewable diesel. And combined, that represented a 2.5% blend level in the diesel fuel pool. This time, we're not really blending anything beyond trial volumes in aviation and marine and rail.
Okay, so I'm just going to do some really back-of-the-envelope math here. Assuming that ethanol sells for roughly the same as sort of oil-based products, you're talking about a business that's in the range of $3 billion to $5 billion a year.
That's right.
Is that so? $3 billion, $5 billion a year, in terms of context, is about 5% of what we sell in the oil world, right? In Canada, it's $100 billion a year, roughly, ballpark, today's prices. So that, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, and what are you seeing? Are you seeing that? What's the growth rate? Like, what are you seeing that growing, and where are we going?
Well, the opportunity looking out to 2030 is getting intense scrutiny right now because the Clean Fuel Standard, which the federal government will release the draft regulation on in the next few weeks, is going to set a performance standard to reduce the carbon intensity of liquid fuels from 2022 to 2030. That signal will be in the market in addition to provincial biofuel policies that are also in place in provinces from British Columbia to Ontario, and Quebec is adopting one as well. So collectively, in terms of the signal, we're seeing that production capacity in Canada could grow 2.5 times to maybe 7.5 billion liters per year. There'd be a modest amount of growth in the biodiesel capacity, perhaps a doubling of ethanol production capacity. And then the biggest segment of growth is forecast to be related to renewable diesel, co-processing, and bio-crude production capacity. And that could represent an aggregate of 1.5 billion liters or more. And that modeling of the Clean Fuel Standard was also just recently released, and you can find that on our website, and your listeners are welcome to get the data underneath the market study as well.
Yeah, we'll put links, by the way, to your report as well as the Navis report that you just referred to. So I have a question. If we go back around 2010, that's when a lot of provinces in Canada started to mandate some level of biofuels use.
Yep.
And if you look at the data, we didn't actually increase our domestic production very much after that point. Instead, we relied on more imports. Why was that, and why do you think it would be different this time?
Yeah, it's not a simple answer. There's various aspects to establishing biofuel production capacity in Canada and what the drivers were. Going back to 2006, when Prime Minister Harper first announced a renewable fuel strategy for Canada. I'll break it down by the different segments. In biodiesel, we actually built the majority of our commercial capacity in Canada after 2010, when a couple of large-scale plants came online after that date. And we're very close to having a trade balance with the U.S. in terms of our imports and exports of biodiesel. However, the next generation biofuels were not so successful. There was a next generation biofuel fund that SDTC had in the previous decade, and it really didn't deploy a lot of capital, and our regulatory design wasn't very competitive compared to the U.S. And so we didn't see any renewable diesel capacity built out until the Parkland refinery in the Vancouver area recently started co-processing animal fats and used cooking oils and vegetable oil to produce lower carbon fuels at their Port Moody refinery. On the ethanol side, it was a bit of a mix. We had a lot of build out prior to 2010. And then after 2010, there were several major plants built or expanded. And we had the first municipal solid waste-based advanced ethanol project commercialized after that date as well. But what happened in the ethanol market was demand exceeded the regulatory base limit of 5%. And as I mentioned earlier, we're blending 6.5%. And that's because ethanol is below gasoline in price. Generally, it's been priced below gasoline, and it has an octane-enhancing value, which is also valuable to the fuel suppliers to use as a blend stock for their premium ethanol blends. So that increased demand use got ahead of Canadian production, and last few years we've been fairly consistently relying on about 1.3 billion liters of imported ethanol from the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I'm going to get back to this clean fuel standard, which, Doug, you've already mentioned. And I know, Jackie, you and I have talked about and are going to talk about a lot more because it's forthcoming. And, you know, the clean fuel standard simplistically sort of mandates that fuels like gasoline need to be diluted. You know, it's like a blood thinner with biofuels because, as you alluded earlier, Doug, the carbon emissions is significantly less from the biofuels, depending on the biofuel. We're trying to get that 90 grams per megajoule in gasoline down by blending in more biofuels to dilute it out. So I want to talk about that a little bit, because if we start mandating effectively this type of dilution, it's going to give us that pull on biofuels. And you mentioned that a large fraction of those biofuels still come from the crops and so on. So what is that going to do to the price of these fuels? It sounds like to me it's almost a bonanza for the farming community.
In terms of the clean fuel standard, it's difficult to know. They haven't published the draft of the regulation yet. And there's a lot of analysis that is really left looking at the low carbon fuel standard structures of British Columbia and California and Oregon are the markets where comparable regulations are in place. But the thing that's very different is that the clean fuel standard will allow far more credit generation in the upstream oil and gas sector. And we're also expecting to see a lot more penetration and credits generated from EV use, which is accelerating now. It was very slow in the last decade, but it's picking up. And then there's going to be hydrogen fuel cell vehicles that come into the market. So there's a lot more supply opportunities and flexibility in the clean fuel standard than in the market instruments we've got. But we can look backwards, and we've got hard data on what have the fuel regulations, the renewable fuel standards, and the BCLCFS cost consumers in the last decade. Well, we've got data from 2010 to 2018. And over that period, ethanol averaged 15.4 cents below gasoline. Biodiesel was on average 3.9 cents above diesel fuel, and renewable diesel prices aren't public, but you can sort of back calculate them using SEC disclosure statements. And we as Navius estimates that they're about 64 cents higher than biodiesel.
Effectively, the refiner can either buy credits or buy biofuels, right? And what you're saying is if the credits, but they're going to be expensive. So it strikes me that buying the biofuels is going to be the lower cost solution to address this issue. And I still have this sense that the pull on agricultural feedstocks is going to be quite significant as we go forward, and that could result in higher prices.
Let me jump in with the modeling of the agricultural commodity markets and the fuel markets. And this is a report that we just released last week that took what's called a global partial equilibrium model. So took all the agricultural commodities and biofuel types in the market and the fossil fuel products globally. It was all around the world in terms of picking up the demand for biofuels and the pull on commodities, et cetera. And it ran four scenarios to see what the CFS could look like based on, you know, the preliminary design information that we've got. And the estimate in the highest biofuel use scenario really doesn't affect ethanol prices in Canada. So they stay in the 60-cent range. And that's because the global supply of both the feedstocks and the ethanol are in surplus capacity. And in Canada just is not a large fuel consumer at the end of the day compared to the globe.
I was going to add too, Doug, first of all, we are small, but also there's a limit to how much biofuels can really be blended in before you run into problems with the fuel distributors saying, I can't really keep putting more biofuels in, because the automobiles have a maximum limit in terms of how much ethanol they can take, right?
Yeah, but it's quite a bit ahead of where we are now. In the modeling I was just referring to, the blend level for the gasoline pool stays below, I think it's around the 14% level. And this will not be entirely ethanol either. When you have a platform like the Parkland refinery co-processing animal fats and vegetable oils, they're producing a lower carbon gasoline out of their FCC unit there, and also, you know, some other fuel cuts. But
right. And those fuels don't have the blend limits when
they're processed that way. Exactly. Yeah.
So you have ethanol getting to 14% or so, and then in diesel, what would you have the biofuels?
Yeah, that scenario runs up to just shy of 9%, and that's split between biodiesel going up into the, I think, the 3 or 4% range, and renewable diesel taking up the balance.
You know, one interesting thing you talked about is biofuels being cheaper. I mean, that wasn't my impression. I thought biofuels were a lot more expensive than petroleum-based fuels. Is that generally been the case that they're cheaper, and you expect that to continue even with this increased demand?
It's generally been the case in, particularly in the ethanol and gasoline market. Over the past decade, we've seen ethanol sit below gasoline. Then you have to adjust for the energy density because it's a lower energy dense product.
You have to use more because you don't get as much horsepower per liter. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and the fuel consumer has to come back and fuel up more. So there's more marketing costs and there's more tax costs because tax are applied on a liter basis, not on energy. And anyway, that's all calculated in the Navius report. And that's where they come up with, you know, on average, I think it was in 2018, the average fuel consumer in Canada would have saved $27. But on the diesel side, if you have a long haul trucker driving 120,000 kilometers a year on diesel fuel, and they're using the 2.5% biofuel blend, the costs to that trucker are $200 a year more. And they could have lowered that cost had they used more biodiesel, but a lot of the fuel suppliers have chosen to use renewable diesel, which has a higher price point. There's another part, though, too, Peter. You were mentioning earlier about, you know, it being this cheapest form of compliance. Because of the design flexibility of the Clean Fuel Standard, that may not actually be as straightforward as that. You can take a high-cost abatement cost strategy like carbon capture and storage and sequestering carbon. Let's say the notional price per ton of sequestered carbon is $200, which is above what it would cost if you used any of the biofuels. It might still be the preferable strategy for a refiner if they, on a net basis, can maintain their market share of gasoline and diesel as they get refining margins, and if they're linked upstream, they've got crude oil margins. And so net to them, a higher price strategy can still be a more profitable option.
Right. So basically what you're saying is you can achieve some of the targets anyway by lowering the carbon content of gasoline.
Yeah. And then the other thing that comes into it is the Clean Fuel Standard has a gaseous and a solid class regulation that is meant to come out in 2023. And if those proceed, all of the fuel types can trade up to 10% of the credits between them. And the modeling that was done was, we were part of a steering group with Enercan in 2019 that looked at the competitiveness of investment in Canada to build these plants. And the modeling that was done then showed that the solid biomass players, the wood pellets are just simply gasifying and turning biomass into energy. They generate the cheapest credits. Mm-hmm. And so there's likely to be a pretty good supply below the liquid fuel market of credits that are more affordable.
Basically, you're saying that this Clean Fuel Standard, there's many ways to comply. You think biofuels will get part of that? You're saying a 2.5 times potential growth in the market over the next, is it 10 years?
Yeah, so to 2030.
Yeah, but you'll see credits coming from other sorts of ways, which I think is good, right? We don't want to have this policy only generate sort of one option. Mm-hmm. There can be diversity in how we meet this. But I want to come back to this question of, will you see investment in Canada? Because I think one of the biggest objections I've heard to this plan is that it's just going to make us rely more on importing biofuels from foreign countries. And so consumers in Canada pay more for their fuel and nothing goes into our economy.
I think it's a fair concern to try and capture the maximum economic benefit we can from our climate policies. If we're going to transition or transform sectors to reduce our emissions, we absolutely want to capture the jobs and the economic benefits of that activity in our country. And, you know, keep in mind, we did build over the course of the last 10 to 15 years a $5 billion sector in the biofuels community. To attract money in Canada right now, I think there's two things we have to do. One, we have to resolve the policy risks and finalize fuel regulations. The Clean Fuel Standard started back in 2016, came out of the Pan-Canadian Framework, which at the time there was a political accord between most of the provinces and the federal government, called for a Clean Fuel Standard. And fast forward 4.5 years now, we don't have much political accord anymore on things around climate policy and fuel regulation. And that definitely presents risk to capital investment. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if you're investing in fossil fuel production or biofuels or synthetic fuels, where Canada is going is hard to see given the conflict between the political parties.
Let's go to sort of the final topic, which I thought was further along than it really was, the use of non-food, I'll call it organisms, because, you know, there are technologies out there that don't use crops at all. Basically, you stick genetic material simplistically in a vat and create biofuels. What is the state of that future technology?
Rapidly advancing would be a short answer. As I mentioned earlier, these synthetic fuels, which you can synthesize from carbon dioxide capture, are moving into production. And we've got these waste-based platforms like Enerkams up in Edmonton, which converts municipal solid waste into fuels. Those are at the finished fuel level. At the other end of the spectrum, and there's a lot going on in the bio-crude space where companies are using forest residues or agricultural residues to an extent that still protects soil health, but takes some of that biomass away, converts it into a crude oil that can go into a petroleum refinery. And then you can make all of the fuel cuts that come out of the refining process. And there's a number of companies that are pursuing technologies that are based in Canada that are advancing that. And the first commercial scale production of bio oil or bio crude opened up in Quebec about a year ago. And so that's a market that really enables existing refining platforms to move into producing cleaner fuels without having to rebuild the entire refining complex. And, you know, the way the math boils down, if you convert 1% of Canada's refining capacity to a bio-based crude, you add over 1 billion liters of biofuel production per year.
So do you think that refiners in Canada will make investments to do that because of a tool like this?
Right now, there are reported to be over 15 projects that are under evaluation in the renewable diesel / co-processing category. I think a lot of those would be refiners, upgraders, or companies that are looking to co-locate beside those assets because there's very good cost effectiveness to intertie your hydrogen and your off gases and things like that. That's just one segment of the activity. There's another 3 times that number of capital projects that we can identify out to 2030 that in total, I think the system is looking at about $15 billion of capital investment. Brings me back to the earlier question about, you know, how are we going to make it competitive to invest in Canada? One is we need to resolve our political risk and our regulatory risk and put the final regulations into the light of day. But we also have to have competitive investment returns and the U.S. market and European markets, they've been, as they are in many sectors, ahead of us in terms of stimulating investment in their communities using tax policies, tax credits, blenders tax credits, producers tax credits. And we saw a lot of investment go to those jurisdictions because it was more profitable to use to build those facilities in those markets. And they're close by larger markets in terms of fuel consumption, too. You know, we're very much looking to see what it is that the federal government will do with its climate plan to 2030. What are the fiscal measures to help align those signals with capital investors? And the provinces have a role to play in that as well.
Thanks, Doug. I mean, this has been really a fascinating discussion. I think we can carry on for a lot longer.
Yeah, no, we really appreciate it. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners did as well.
Yeah, I appreciate your interest and look forward to reconnecting as this moves ahead. Yeah,
for sure.
Thank you both.
Yep.
Great. And thanks to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell someone else about it and rate us on the app that you listen to.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.